Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy.
20 years of tasting, Tony. Well, I've known you for like a bunch of years, and you've been tasting a lot of wine, so I think we should talk about that.
Okay.
So I'm kind of thinking that, you know, one of the things that I think is sort of fascinating about you is that you've been tasting in France and Italy and Spain for a very long time, and that you've developed relationships with farmers and winemakers and different houses all over the Western Europe, basically. And what has changed? What have you seen change over the last, I mean, we've been doing this much longer than 20 years, but, you know, I've known you for about 22 of them. So what's changed, let's say, in the last 20 years?
Well, it's a big generational change. I mean, that's, people have a different outlook. The kids of people who'd gotten through World War II were the last generation. Mm-hmm. And they're a lot of the folks that went through sort of the quote-unquote modernizing, and then back to this generation that has gone through and controlled a lot of these vineyards and wine producers have been a lot of the ones that have gone back to what their great-grandparents would have done in a lot of ways. A lot of the mechanization, a lot of chemical additives, a lot of things to make the process easier, this generation has been taking away. Growing things more organically, biodynamically. The trend has been towards doing the hard work to come up with a smaller amount of fruit that has a lot of flavor. I mean, that's a general trend. It doesn't mean that there's not giant, almost industrial farms of grapes to produce lots of inexpensive and still pretty tasty wine from a lot of different places.
What have you seen, sort of some specific things that you've seen change in farming when you say, you know, it's gone from this kind of modernization period to going back to old time ways? What has changed?
Well, I mean, it's chemicals and fertilizers. Those are things that...
Well, we found out they're an enemy, which we didn't realize. People didn't realize when they first started using them, right?
Well, they're not just an enemy. I mean, as far as having additives in the end product, they're an enemy if you're chasing flavor. It's a little bit like heirloom tomatoes. People, they get very excited when they see great heirloom tomatoes. It doesn't mean that every year heirloom tomatoes are going to be fantastic.
Right, right.
It means the right years and the right type, they're going to be unlike any other tomato that you can have. So, I mean, very simple parallel. If you take a grape, a very best type of grape, that isn't going to do perfectly every year, but if it does very, very well this particular year, in this particular place, it's going to have very much its own personality. And because of that, it's going to make a unique end product. And if you're using additives in the process of making the wine, if you're using fertilizers to stimulate growth, you're going to have less flavor. Those grapes are going to have less of an original story to tell than they would have had otherwise.
And when you say additives in the wine, what would that have been?
Most typically with tartrates. With any number of things over the years have been tried to sort of keep things clean and bug-free. Whether it's, I mean, sulfites are almost always there in very small quantities, you hope. But that's something
that helps.
And
that's to keep the wine from oxidizing? Or does it have other reasons?
It's a preservative.
A preservative.
The first person that struck a sulfur match and put it inside of a wine barrel to clean it up before they put the wine in it. That's the person that figured it out. Yeah.
That's amazing. I didn't know that's how it started.
Wow. Yeah. It's like the first person that saw an oyster and thought it was food. Like, okay, you're very, very intuitive.
No doubt. And so that's farming, sort of farming changes. What do you think, you know, philosophy with winemakers? Have you seen, you know, is it generational as well with making the wine or producing the wine? Once it's in the barrel, are you seeing any philosophy changes?
I think more people respect the process. This generation previous to the one, essentially the people, I'll speak for myself, my age and a little older, they're still trying very hard to make wine, to craft wine. And some were understanding that, and the generation prior to that, same thing. I think that coming out of World War II into the 80s especially, there's a lot of trying to make wine. of certain styles. And I think that's something that has begun to change more and more with the generation now. And there were people that didn't, I mean, I'm generalizing unfairly about a lot of individuals that made individual decisions, but in talking in gross trends, mm-hmm. yeah, there's been more of a less is more approach last couple of years, last decade, let's say.
And that definitely leads into the next question, which is, how have you seen people's tastes change over the last 20 years, even 30 years?
Consumers?
Yes, consumers. So people drinking the wine, buying the wine.
It's interesting. What happens retail and what happens in restaurants is a little bit different, but not enormously different. The outcome that people are after in restaurants, especially fancier restaurants, is a little bit different. If you're going to a shop to... You're not trying to impress anyone besides yourself for the most part, unless you're buying a gift or unless you're a particular collector. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a much more purely price quality and quality judged by your personal taste, period, sort of a buying decision. In a restaurant, there's a whole consideration of what's actually happening at the table. Is it a hot date and you're trying to communicate something mm-hmm. with your selection? Is it a business meeting and you're trying to add something to your personal brand by choosing wine X to show that you're this solid or this sophisticated? It's interesting, all those different inferences that are there from something that you drink.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then there are different occasions too. You're just celebrating, maybe it's your anniversary or your birthday, maybe you're leaning more towards, since Americans tend to think of champagne as...
It's either champagne or maybe a particular year or mm-hmm. We had this vacation and inevitably, I get the, we're vacationed in Tuscany. We want a wine from Tuscany.
Sure, sure.
And it's very lovely. So you find them wine from Tuscany.
Yeah, memories. That's cool.
So that's kind of part of it. But it's an interesting, you introduce a lot more human, a lot more romantic, and a lot more business-oriented influences on what people choose versus the more purely economic decision in retail. All of that being said, I think the tastes are for flavor. I mean, that's people like flavor. Mm-hmm. They don't respond that well to things that don't have a lot of flavor. And sometimes it's easier to taste more flavor. And it's kind of, let me use it as an analogy, rock and roll music. Really, really loud AC/DC. It's really easy to kind of get. Okay? That
yes.
you're gonna get it.
Right. I get it. Okay? Yeah.
Learning to listen to songwriter X and their acoustic guitar, mm-hmm. it better be exactly the right song to get your attention. It better be exactly the right melody to kind of catch you, because someone else is playing AC/DC at full volume. And there are wines that are both of those, you know? That's
mm-hmm. Sure.
And they absolutely have their own qualities. But it's like if you're at a party, you better take AC/DC. Everyone's going to hear it. If you're having a very more contemplative time, maybe you want the acoustic guitar. And there's no judgment implied in any of that sort of business. And even when you think I'm judging you for that kind of a thought process, I'm not. I want you to have something that you like to drink. That's my own personal feeling. That's... What I want to drink may be different from what you want to drink. There are bad wines and there are good wines. Large majority of wines that are produced commercially are good wines, meaning that they are made cleanly, that they have flavor, that they will keep well enough, and they can be attractive with food. That doesn't mean, going back to music, that you like everyone's song, and that, let's say, that you love country music or that you love hip-hop or that you love Neil Young. Maybe, you know, that's... There are lots of flavors and there's lots of reasons for that. And what's fun is the listening. What's fun is the learning to get it. I think the more and more that people have an opportunity to taste, using the metaphor, to listen, mm-hmm. then the more they'll find exactly what it is that appeals to them. And they learn to sort of slow things down because it's a physical exercise. Repetition and focus usually means higher skill, better outcomes. you'll begin to understand a lot better what it is that you're tasting with practice.
And with tasting, what is the process? How do you taste? How do you begin to learn what you might like? How does that work?
A couple of things that I'll often say to people, if you can get other people together, it's great. It is, frankly, slightly sad just to pop the cork on something and sit and do the analysis by yourself.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that's not the intention of the person that put the wine in that bottle.
Right.
It's also enormously better for you to learn to taste with more than one thing open.
I agree. I love that.
Well, you learn relationship between the two. You learn all of the sort of different parameters and specifics about what happens on your palate, how you take in what flavors, what the differences are, all the very specific notes that are there. You get those a lot more completely when you have two things that are distinct from each other. If you have someone else to taste that with, to notice those things, that's great.
Yeah, because in the end, two heads are better than one. It's always nice to hear what someone else thinks about and what do they notice.
And more than one bottle open at a time, someone else to taste patiently with you. And an important thing, and really it's not the most important thing, but having some kind of disciplined methodology where you would take notes or where you would just go through and slow down the process of tasting. It's not just boom, you drink it. Well, that was kind of fruity. That wasn't actually probably the point. Mm-hmm. That's not part of the joy of that. You don't listen to music and think, well, that's loud. Well, that's in a minor key. So, I mean, for me, I just use your senses. To me, without using all the great analytical forms that are available, you know, that you can download from the internet and fill in all the boxes, I think a very quick and easy way, almost like a cocktail napkin method, just use your five senses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that and the order that you would use them in to taste. So what do you get visually? What do you get aromatically? What do you get in a tactile way? I guess sound doesn't apply so much.
No.
Unless you're swishing it around really violently. Or the sound
I'm
of
not
the screams.
Sure what that would tell you.
The sound of the screams of the people with the white carpet that you're doing this on. No, that large majority of what you taste is going to be aromatic.
Sure.
Visual will give you clues, and visually we have strong reminders what the color is. Is it, if it's a red wine, is it more violet or is it more, which is, you know, purple, something more brick red, something more orange, something more pink or magenta. You know, there's a whole color spectrum. It's not all the exact same, although they will all stay in that white carpet. So that's something to take in. What the viscosity appears in the glass, always interesting to take in.
Can I ask you what viscosity suggests, please?
Suggests alcohol, suggests density of the polyphenolic, that's words I didn't want to say.
Sorry.
And the density of the polyphenolic material.
Got it. Okay.
You know, basically kind of how chewy is that.
So the more dripping down the sides of the glass, what does that mean? Or the less?
No, that tells you glycerin, and glycerin is related to alcohol. So you may have Beaujolais that's 12% alcohol. You may have Red Zinfandel that's 15.5% alcohol. Mm-hmm. And some of that is indicated through the visuals.
Any suggestions for how you can possibly open, you know, more than one bottle of wine? Thoughts on how to do a good tasting?
Be really thirsty. No. Because I would always suggest that you spit, honestly.
Sure.
That you have a vessel that you don't mind spitting into. And I don't think that the being really intoxicated is the point. I think the learning is the point. If you happen to relax a little bit along the way, I don't think that hurts anyone's feelings. But I mean, you want to find someone else with like interest. And it's a little bit like if you find another tennis player, if they're a little better than you, that might be good. But beware, if that's all trick shots, you're not going to learn anything. It's the same thing with another wine taster. If you're a novice, or if you have moderate experience, find someone in that bracket that's not going to try to color things for you
right.
too much one way or another. You'll get the most honest
That seems like more fun anyway, tasting with someone on your level.
You get the most honest tasting.
Yeah.
But get those folks together, have things at proper temperature. And often I think having things that have a relationship with each other is much more interesting. Are there two 2014 Malbecs from different parts of Argentina? 2015 is a great year for Beaujolais. Are there Beaujolais crew from three different villages that you and four friends get together and put together and open together? That kind of thing is more interesting. Is there a wine that you have five vintages of in the cellar, or that between you and other people, you can put five vintages together and taste them beginning with the youngest to the oldest?
Yeah, I've done that before. That's a lot of fun when you have somebody that can, you know, bring another vintage that you have.
Seeing a picture of each of the years and seeing the changes that happen to the wine through time.
It's fascinating. Yeah, for sure.
No question. And when we come back on Formidable Phone Food and Wine, we'll spend a little bit more time on wine. And coming up in the next segment, we have an interview with Dwight Chu from James River Distillery, right close by in Virginia. All of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we have with us Dwight Chu from James River Distillers. How are you, Dwight?
I'm doing very well. How are you guys today?
Great.
Good, Dwight. Thanks for being with us today.
Happy to.
We've been having a big discussion about what's changed with wine and also how to learn more about wine. And Cindy was asking me off the air about spirits and what's changed with that. And yes, there's been a bit of an explosion in cocktails, and there's a whole other generation of consumers that want to entertain themselves with wine and spirits and beer. And so maybe talk about what the evolution has been for you guys and what your background is.
So personally, my background, I previously worked for a brewery, and before that I was actually ran an organic farm for a little while, which is how I got interested in microbiology. Before that, I was actually a cook in restaurants. So able to tie all of those things together, being head distiller at James River, it allows me to sort of bring my cooking and recipe knowledge through the microbiology into the process knowledge I learned at the brewery. And that's one of the things about the whole craft distilling movement is the craft beer and also the local wine movement really kind of set the stage for us. Really getting people interested in different ingredients, you know, same styles such as gin, but different flavor profiles and using interesting ingredients with those.
What are the big trends right now? What's taking off? What can you not keep up with?
I'd say the some of the largest trends right now are sort of the sort of hyper local movement, I guess you could maybe call it. There are certain gin distillers who they literally go out and forage their own, you know, super local ingredients, that kind of thing. We don't necessarily get to that level at James River. However, we do try to source as many of our products locally as possible and also try to use as many interesting and different ingredients as possible.
I can't imagine foraging for all the botanicals just because of the variability of the spirit. I'm sure that would be a challenge.
Absolutely. And that's and sort of how I mentioned how, you know, we're sort of following behind the craft beer movement, is now you have a consumer base who is, I guess, a little more willing to work with you, I guess, as your flavor profiles develop from season to season. And, you know, they understand that, yes, we are using agricultural products that are local and change based on the season. And so even if you work with the exact same recipe, you're going to have a slightly different product year to year. And luckily, a lot of the consumer base is totally fine with that, and actually a lot of people are, they get thrilled by that. You know, they can keep a bottle around from last year's batch compared to this year's and kind of taste the difference.
So what's an example of a product where that's worked for you?
I would say an example would be our, speaking for ourselves, our Commonwealth gin, for which we use two different kinds of hops as well as fresh cantaloupe. And so, you know, both hops and cantaloupe being, you know, agriculture ingredients, you know, one's a literal flower, the other is fruit, you really do see slight variations, you know, from crop year to crop year.
And but the recipe for the that particular gin stays the same, just variation in the seasonality of the products?
Yes, so you see some variation in the seasonality, and so that's one of the challenges of, you know, being the head distiller, is I have to, you know, for example, with the fresh cantaloupe, if I am using some cantaloupe that is perfectly ripe, you know, middle of the summertime, super fresh, you know, I can use half a cantaloupe per batch. If it gets a little farther into the season, I might be starting to use, you know, like a whole cantaloupe per batch in order to get that same level of flavor that I was getting earlier on.
That sounds pretty tricky, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The cooking experience helps you out there.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, every single batch I'm tasting, you know, not just at the end, but also throughout the middle of the batch. I have a spoon in my pocket where, as stuff is coming off of the still, I'm taking tiny sips from the spoon and making sure that all the flavors are coming over just the way it's supposed to. And also, you know, if from one batch to the next, if I do need to adjust, you know, the levels of certain amounts of ingredients, I can do that.
So with your gin, do you, especially considering the fact that you have cantaloupe in there, are there some certain recipes, drinks that you make with your gin that you think are particularly exciting?
Certainly, yes. So the Commonwealth specifically is, because it's an American or New Western style gin, which means that it's fairly light on the juniper. It's more floral and fruity. It's really good in kind of your more floral, your more fruity cocktails. Makes an amazing mule, makes an amazing gimlet. Punches, actually. It is very, very good. We're looking forward to using that. Actually, my family this wintertime, I'm looking forward to making a holiday punch with some with the Commonwealth. And then we have two other gins as well. One, the Continental, is our traditional style, which means that it is juniper forward. Also include sarsaparilla root and black pepper in the ingredient in the recipe. And so that one we use in sort of different kind of cocktails. That's better in your more savory kind of things. You know, makes an amazing martini, great gin and tonic, that kind of stuff.
What is sarsaparilla?
Sarsaparilla root. It's from a plant. It's actually one of the few ingredients that we cannot get locally. But one of the reasons why we use that in that recipe is because so all three of our gins and our aquavit as well are all made from Virginia-grown organic corn.
Mm-hmm.
And the corn, when we use that as the base spirit, it imparts just a slight amount of sort of corn flavor, basically. And the sarsaparilla root actually perfectly complements and kind of rounds out that corn flavor that's in there. I'm trying to imagine how to describe the flavor of sarsaparilla.
Yeah.
It's almost like a root beer-esque type flavor, but not as strong.
And where does it come from then, since you said it's not local?
Yeah, it's actually actually sourced from India.
Oh, okay. Very good.
I am ready to taste a root beer gin.
Yeah, that sounds kind of amazing.
Well,
it's exciting.
Accent in there, but yes.
Sure.
So, is there something that is your holy grail right now? Is there a spirit that you're trying to achieve that you've not been able to get to yet?
So, and again, that it kind of pulls it back to sort of how the craft distilling industry is different than sort of your mass distillers. You know, if we want to experiment, do small batches, do little bits at a time, we can, and we can just sell just at the distillery here. You know, your major distilleries, you know, they have to make thousands of cases at a time, kind of thing. I would say our holy grail right now is the Oster V, which is our aquavit, which we do distribute up in Baltimore. We make that. So an aquavit is a traditional Scandinavian spirit, and so our recipe is caraway, dill, and fennel seeds, a little bit of orange peel, and then our personal twist on it, we actually steep it for 48 hours along with some Virginia River oyster shells.
Oh, wow.
Out of the Rappahannock River, and
that's
you wind
super
up
cool.
with a hint of oyster flavor
okay.
in the aquavit.
That's amazing.
Sounds like a perfect partner for the caviar you like so much, Chef.
Exactly.
I imagine it would be, yes. Makes a great oyster shooter, makes the best Bloody Mary you've ever had.
Wow.
Also makes a super fascinating martini as well.
So are there spirits from other distillers in the U.S. that people should know about? And is there something that sparked you, with your interest in distilling that you had to drop everything else and just go do this?
So this was actually, I would have to say this is more or less my dream job. Actually, not more or less, it absolutely is. So I previously worked for a brewery, as I said, but I only got into that industry because at the time, this was actually up in Maryland, and at the time there weren't any distilleries in Maryland. And so as a way to sort of get into the industry, started working at the brewery, because as some people may or may not know, here at the distillery, we actually, so for the base for our gins, we make a corn beer first. For the base for our rum, we make a sugar wine. And so sort of half of our process is making a beer or a wine, but then we just take it a few extra steps. If you're interested in some other spirits, I would highly recommend, if any of your listeners can get a hold of the St. George Terroir Gin out of California, they're one of those distilleries I mentioned that they literally go out and forage for the ingredients themselves. It's very, very good.
Do you have a pet, cocktail made with one of your spirits, with a pet dish that is on your mind?
That is a good question. I just enjoyed a cocktail the other night. So I'm a vegetarian. My wife is vegan. So we actually did a garbanzo flour frittata with and I had a Commonwealth gin cocktail with that. It was very, very good.
So Dwight, when you taste spirits, you talk about checking batches. When you taste spirits, whether it's then or if it's at the bar, what do you look for? What is your process?
So it actually gets a little tricky at times. So the first complicating factor when I'm tasting it is the fact that when it's coming off of the still, it's generally over 180 proof, so 90 to 91% alcohol. So, my taste buds are sort of having to fight against the that high amount of alcohol in there.
So it gets your full attention.
Yes. If you do too much at a time, it actually will kind of sort of wreck your taste buds, and you almost can't continue to taste. So that's why, like I mentioned, the spoon I carry, I just have to take just a little bits at a time. The other complicating factor is that for each one of our gin recipes and the aquavit as well, as the distillation run is progressing, which can go anywhere from 5 to 7 hours, depending on the botanicals that are in the recipe, it's going to pick up different flavors at different times throughout the run. For example, our Commonwealth gin, the hops and the fresh cantaloupe, those ingredients, because they are more delicate, they're softer, they will actually come over first in the very beginning of the run, and then towards the end, it'll start to pick up some of the harder, the more dense ingredients, things such as we have little bits of cardamom and little bits of black peppercorns in there as well. That's sort of one of the things, I guess I just have to say, it's just based off of experience, but tasting it enough where I know that, okay, at this part of the run, it should taste like this, and then towards the end, it should be tasting like this. And then just as we're getting to the end, that's actually when the hops reach what's called the isomerization temperature, which means that they start to get bitter. And so I have to sort of catch it just before it gets to that point so that I don't impart any of the bitterness into the final product.
Seems like that's a really good smarty pants word for sharing distillation knowledge with your friends. What is the isomerization temperature of Spirit X, Bob?
Yes. Hops is actually boiling. Boiling temperature of water, so 212 degrees. The whole reason that beer is bitter is because they've boiled the hops in the beer. If they didn't boil the hops, then you would only get the floral aspects of it. You wouldn't actually get the bitterness.
And you're on it.
Thank you.
So what do you think for the future? What do you think is the next, what are the plans for you guys, and what do you think is the next trend in craft spirits?
So personally, here at James River, we are focused on, we're a fairly compact distillery space-wise here. So we're looking at doing small batch stuff, looking at collaborations with breweries, wineries, cideries, that kind of thing. Also, our rum we release as a collaboration with a local restaurant and bar here in town, the Rogue Gentleman. And I would have to say that the industry as a whole is going to be moving, I would think, sort of more towards that. You know, your whiskeys that are made with sorghum and quinoa and other interesting grains, you know, not just your barley, rye, and corn. Your gin, sort of like what we're doing, that are made with different botanicals, interesting things. Also, sort of like how we did with our aquavit, you know, we are the only distillery in Virginia making an aquavit. So sort of going to these sort of what used to be localized, different, interesting spirits and sort of bringing them to a wider audience.
Is there a website people should visit to see what you guys are doing?
Yes, we are at jrdistillery.com. And also should say that if anybody is ever in Richmond, we do tours and tastings 6 days a week. People can show up, they can see how everything is made, and then they get to sample all six of our spirits as well.
That sounds like fun.
That sounds
like come visit you.
Like a lot, yeah.
I hope you do.
Well, thank you very much for being on the program, Dwight.
Thank you so much.
Happy to.
Appreciate it.
Great day.
You too. Well, when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, it's a little bit more wine chatter, and then Chef Cindy Wolf is going to suffer under a chef challenge. All of that and more on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf. All right, Tony, I have another question.
I bet you do.
I do. Well, we started to talk about, you know, kind of the changes over the last 20 or 30 years. You know, when you've been writing wine lists for a long time. So what has, you know, sort of how has your philosophy changed when you write a wine list? And what's that all about? What kind of changes have you gone through with that process?
I always try to be really focused about what was coming out of the kitchen. If it's on the list, I have a hard time just throwing something on the list because I know it's going to sell, which is probably business stupid, but that's just, there needs to be wine that makes sense with the food that's coming out of the kitchen.
Sure.
And
as a chef, I greatly appreciate that philosophy.
Well, you want each one to improve the other from the experience. I mean,
that's what they're for. One, the wine needs food, and frankly, food needs wine. They're just a perfect marriage.
I think
or
one
they
thing,
be.
And they can also be just dreadful.
Yeah, and they can
dreadful.
Be horrible. Yeah. Right. But if you have the perfect marriage, then that's pretty good, serious stuff, you know, to have a wine that's really complementing the food. It changes it all.
Yeah, each one should improve the other.
Yeah, it makes the full circle. So, and also, let's talk about Psalms. And sort of how people, when they're in a restaurant, you know,
you get this sommeliers.
Yeah. So you get this, you know, gigantic book dropped on your table and you're like, oh God, what am I supposed to do with this thing? You know, first of all, I don't have an hour and a half to read it. Or maybe it's a little list, whatever it is. But I mean, you can kind of be confronted with who knows what as far as the wine list goes. And then you can be kind of, you never know what the psalm's going to be like or if there is one. But mostly, how does a guest sort of navigate through all that? And in the end, I know it's the psalm's job to make them comfortable. So, but let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, sommelier is a part of the service team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of an old-fashioned thing to call a sommelier in the States is a wine waiter, purely right. Someone that's meant to go fetch the wine that you want.
Sure.
Not to belittle it, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's any more or less important than any other position on a service team. If someone fails, everyone looks bad. That's one. You hope that person understands a lot about what's happening in the kitchen, too. And you hope that that person listens really well to what you say you want, and also understands what it is that you're saying. Because let's say that you're an accountant, you have a very particular language and you're very well versed in it, or you're in medicine and you're very well versed in a particular language. You're not expected to be, I don't expect you to be versed in everything having to do with wine. You don't need to be. You need to come in. I need to figure out what you're saying, regardless of the words that you're using, and find things that are going to please you, mm-hmm. and make you want to return to dine with us again.
Yeah.
And so that should be the motivation of the sommelier that's in that room. Now, the business of getting the big book. On that big book, usually, if the bigger the book, the more excited the place is and people in the place are about what's in the cellar. And usually the bigger the book, the more dedicated to wine service someone is in that restaurant, if not the entire team. So that doesn't have to be intimidating. That can be fun. You know, that right. can be exciting.
Mm-hmm.
People often gravitate immediately to, when they open a list, oh my God, what do I know the name of? What do I know? I don't think that that's... Oh, thank goodness for the internet and people's phones. This is the only time I really like to see in the restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll grab their phone and they'll look up Priorat and where is it and something about it and who's a good producer. And that's great. That doesn't hurt my feelings at all. I can tell them very specifically what it is that I know and think about the Priorat that I have sitting in the cellar and what it's doing right now and what it's going to do with the dishes that we're serving, but that doesn't bother me in the least. If that makes someone more comfortable, what's interesting is when people just go chasing scores. They want to know, well, how many points did something get? They don't want to learn what the facts are. They just want to know basically the approval rating that the wine has gotten from some particular professional wine writer, or two or three or four. That always makes me a little bit sad. The tasting is the point. I mean, the points are very helpful as a guide, especially if you know your taste versus the taste of a particular critic. But I don't think that's not the be-all, end-all. The point is the experience. The point is the trying things. And I know that for me, that if you try something and you don't dig it, then I don't want you to have it and I don't want you to pay for it.
Sure.
And that's reasonable. Someone shouldn't just push a bottle of wine on you, and then, you know, the fear is always that someone looking down at you and mm-hmm. pushing a bottle of wine on you that you don't want and that's more expensive than you want, or all of these things at one time, and walking away making you feel bad and belittled. And that, it should be fun. You go out to have fun.
Right, right, for sure.
Someone's opening a bottle of wine. It should be fun.
Mm-hmm. You know, I agree. Indeed.
It's not just an intellectual exercise.
Yeah. And along the lines with having a somm at the table, has it always been that the somm will taste the wine at the table? Is that something relatively new?
It's interesting. When I first came up, all of the sommelier had a testvin. These little silver dishes on a chain around your neck, right?
That's right, yeah.
And they'd pour a tiny bit of the wine in that and taste it. First they'd smell the cork, and then they would do that. And the cork will tell you if something is badly corked, meaning it has this really terrible smelly infection that, you know, will add the wrong personality to the wine and make the flavor drop out of it without getting into the analytical part of it. I just always thought the test vine was just kind of messy and strange, and it requires you carrying around a cloth to wipe the thing off with. And it was
sure.
just
yeah, and if it's hanging around your neck, I can get that.
It's
yeah.
just kind of a
especially if you have a dress shirt on.
I thought it was
on.
Kind of gross. You know, that's you know, I'm fussy.
Had that
so.
Been done for hundreds of years? That's it's very a, old, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
So for me, I would always rather taste in a glass,
mm-hmm.
and I'd rather taste instead of like behind the scenes or undercover. I'd rather do it right in front of a guest, and it should be a tiny amount. And why do you taste it? You check to make sure it's correct. The same reason that you want when the fish arrives in the morning, that the chef checks to see that it's fresh and correct.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when you can just smell it. There are times when you can, you know from appearance that you have a problem, mm-hmm. and you don't always have to taste it. It should be a very small quantity. But that, me, I'd rather have someone reassuring me that product is going to be good.
Yeah.
I don't, out of 25.4 ounces in the bottle, the 0.3 ounces that are going to go into that glass, I'm going to be okay without that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it seems a nice thing to not have to put corked wine in your mouth if someone else is able to decipher it for you.
Well, a nice thing for me, Cindy, is when Chef's Challenge
like I know what's
makes
coming
you
here.
Cry.
Oh, boy.
There we go.
All right.
Read it and weep.
All right. Peanuts. Oh, gosh.
Peanuts.
Iberico hemp, which are a legume.
We had the guy.
We talked about that.
Yeah, thank you, listeners, for all of the
I like that.
Peanut responses.
Iberico ham, sweet potatoes. Ooh, I love sweet potatoes. Duck breast, black olives, which would be niçoise. Capers, sour cream.
There are other black olives and niçoise.
Pineapple.
What are you doing
Tony?
With sour cream,
Oh,
Cindy?
Golly. Pineapple, rice, your choice. And what is it? Seckle pears and spicy Italian sausage. Oh, I love spicy Italian sausage. Okay. This is a gross list of food, Tony. All right.
Gross list,
it's
meaning
gross.
A large list?
No. All right. So duck breast. I'm going to score the fat it, side and
it
render
is a list
it
of things
in
my,
the pan.
My grandmother would have been 100 years old. And to celebrate the 100th anniversary of her birth, I made a list of all the food that I know she liked best.
Is that what's happening here?
That's what happened to you.
Okay. So the duck breast, rendered and turn over and sear. Season it well with, rub it with salt and pepper. Cook it to medium rare to medium and let it rest. And those black olives, which are niçoise, I'm going to chop up and add the capers to. Do I have anything else like oil and salt and pepper?
Of course.
And, oh, okay. All right. So with the capers and the niçoise olives, I'll make a little relish. Add a little bit of extra virgin olive oil. I'll make some rice. The spicy Italian sausage will be great in the rice, so I'll saute onions and shallots and butter and dice up the Italian sausage and add it to the pan, work it, get the flavors going, and then add, I'll just use regular rice, long grain rice, and a little bit of chicken stock. And at the end, I'm going to add sweet potato. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to brunoise the sweet potato, which is the smallest of dice. I'm going to cook them off in water with salt and sugar and a little bit of cinnamon. And once they're just al dente, I'm going to add them to that rice process when I add the liquid so that all those things, the Italian sausage, the sweet potatoes, and the rice cook together. And so that's for the duck breast and the relish. It's going to be really weird with that now that I think about it. Sour cream and pineapple. All right, so the pears, I'm going to cook them in apple cider and cinnamon and star anise and fresh orange juice. And when they're tender, I'm going to pull out those dried spices and I'm going to puree them in the food processor with a little bit of sour cream and make a chilled soup. That'll be your quick little hors d'oeuvre. Along with that chilled soup, you're going to have slices of Iberico ham and some peanuts, apparently, because I really don't know what else to do with those. And you know what? I'm going to make that rice differently. I'm going to take out the sweet potatoes.
I wondered.
Yeah, that's weird. And but the rice with the sausage and the olives and the capers, that can be nice together with the duck breast. The sweet potatoes, I'm going to have to boil them, puree them, and add some eggs to them and cream and make a sweet potato flan for dessert with some cracked peanuts on top. Candied peanuts.
Reasonable.
Peanuts chopped up, cooked down with sugar, a little bit of sugar, caramelized sugar. I'll pour that over the top. Yeah. No, I'll make brittle. I'll make brittle with it. Let's see. I'm trying to figure out these peanuts.
Yeah, I would just eat the peanuts with maybe some of the aquavit from Dwight.
Yeah, or I could make sweet potato frites and have those on the table with the Iberico ham. That would be kind of fun. Or chips. I can just keep going on and on. Go ahead, Tony, it's your turn.
It's endless the ways in which you dislike that list of ingredients.
Uh-huh.
All right. Chorizo, New York strip steak. Blue potato, white truffle. Onion, shallot, garlic, olive oil, veal stock. One whole chicken. No, I'm not
going to. Just to throw one in there.
I'm not going to stuff the chicken with the strip steak. Thank you. Ooh, porcini mushrooms, rosemary, bacon, rustic bread, la bomba rice, poblano peppers. Is this food for like 70 people?
Yes. You're making a wedding dinner.
Oh, my God.
That's a wedding dinner.
It's a wedding dinner of choices. There are three main courses on here. All right. Well, the whole chicken, I am going to stuff. I'm going to stuff it with a chorizo and grill the porcinis to get some flavor out of them. And onion and garlic and rosemary. And we'll get that going. The la bomba rice. A little more of the shallot, garlic. The poblano peppers. Roast those guys off. And the bacon ran to the fat. Let's get them going with that rice. That'll be a fun rice. You know, the poblano is not so spicy. Mm-hmm. And strip steak. I mean, in a perfect world, you put that sucker on a spit, well salted, and cook it over a wood fire. Rest it. I'm just telling you, in a perfect world. Uh-huh. You said it's a wedding dinner.
Yeah, I did.
You know, you got to make efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And then and slice that. The veal stock, take it down very tight, and just garnish the slices of the strip with that reduced veal stock,
mm-hmm.
and some slices of the white truffle.
Oh.
Yeah, now I've got your attention.
Yeah, finally.
Mm-hmm. The rustic bread, you can throw at Cindy.
Oh.
For once, I didn't start with the olive oil. I guess I used it to grill the porcinis. All right, well, that was fun. Welcome to your wedding dinner. Well, so what kind of wine do you want to drink with your wedding dinner?
A really, really good Spanish wine. So what would you suggest?
It could be a Priorato.
Mm-hmm.
Like we just talked about, maybe a producer of Vallac. It's pretty great. Should be a Catalan wine, you know. It's all so dramatic there right now. We have a guy who's in harvest right now in Vallac.
What am I eating with the pineapple that I didn't use on my chef's challenge? I just realized I never did anything with the pineapple. Oh, boy. Oh, some of the James River gin. That would be great with the pineapple. Roast it in the oven, a little sugar, puree it in the blender. Yeah.
When did you start drinking gin?
Never.
I guess you're going to get started.
Well, now that I heard this story, it's kind of cool. Why not?
That sounds like trouble.
Yeah. Tony, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today.
Well, if you want to follow Foreman Wolf on social media, Chef Cindy Wolf is?
Chef Wolf on Instagram and Chef Cindy Wolf on Twitter.
Mine is The Real Tony Foreman.
Versus all the fake ones out there.
Hey. There's so many pretenders.
So many pretenders.
if you want to email us, it's foremanwolf@wypr.org. If you want to download this program because you want to hear it again and again and again, or any of the other podcasts, go to the WYPR website, look for the Foreman Wolf page, and thanks for listening.
Happy Sunday.